This meeting of House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:10 p.m. on Tuesday, February 28th in the State Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Johnston, Representative Tarr, Representative Klayman, alternate, and myself, Representative Sponholz. We have a quorum to conduct business. Take this moment to silence your cell phones and turn them all the way off, vibrate, if you can, before we start. I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Alex Beauty Gudice from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as my aide, Ted Madsen. Today we're going to be hearing two bills and a presentation. The first bill is going to be HB 123, Disclosure of Health Care Costs. We'll be hearing from my aide, Bernice Nesbitt, and invited testimony. And then we're going to hold the bill over for next Thursday committee meeting. The second bill up will be a continuation of the hearing for House Bill 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill. We'll hear a brief recap of the bill from the sponsor staff, and then we'll open it up for public testimony. We'll then hold that bill over for amendments on Tuesday and community discussion. Finally, we'll be hearing a presentation from the Key Coalition on their 2017 legislative priorities. And now I would like to come on up. I'd like to recognize that Representative Sadler has joined us. I'd like to invite my legislative aide, Bernice Nesbitt, to present House Bill 123. Before Ms. Nesbitt begins, and while she's sort of settling down, I'll describe my intention in introducing this bill. So knowledge is power, so said Sir Francis Bacon. I think we all know that. Healthcare is the only industry that we have where we as consumers don't know the price before we make a purchase or we utilize a service. This removes one of the fundamental tenets of capitalism, that is the power of the consumer to make choices about what they do or they don't purchase. While HB 123 isn't the silver bullet, we would all like to see solve the problems of, outrageous healthcare costs rising in our system. It does put consumers back where they belong, in the driver's seat, by ensuring they have more information about before they consider making medical purchases. And I want to share a specific example that sort of inspired me in part to introduce this bill, and that was a colleague in the building took a tumble while mountain running and went to the doctor concerned that he had a concussion. He ended up getting an MRI, which actually didn't produce additional data, but also didn't alter the treatment that was recommended by the doctor. When he got a bill for it later on, it was $2,400, and he really lamented that he hadn't known that at the time, because if he had known that it was $2,400, he might have asked the question, do I really need this, and, how is it going to change, the treatment, any additional information you would have of the doctor. And the doctor said, no, we pretty much knew that this is what you had. And so that's a great example of how a little bit of price transparency might have altered the course of that particular healthcare experience. So what we've done with HB 123 is try to create more pricing transparency for consumers that is very simple and clean to implement. We've made it as simple to implement as possible. We understand that there's extremely onerous demands of professionals in the healthcare industry. We know that medical providers spend about 30% of their time or their overhead trying to make sure that they get their billing correct and that they get compensated for care. We don't want to make that more complicated than is necessary. And we don't want to add any additional costs to the state in light of our current fiscal situation. So we think that we've come up with a solution that is very simple and yet helps to inform the process. And for the record, I'd like to recognize that Representative Sullivan Leonard has joined us. Thank you. Ms. Nesbitt, would you like to proceed?
Sure. For the record, my name is Bernice Nesbitt, and I'm staff to Rep. Ivy Sponholz, and I will be going through HB 123 with you. The intent of the sponsor is to create a foundation to increase price transparency in healthcare in Alaska. Transparency and access to healthcare costs empowers consumers to take more financial responsibility for their healthcare. HB 123 does this by requiring healthcare providers and facilities to display the undiscounted prices of their most common healthcare procedures in a public area or on their website if they have one. It is the intent of the sponsor to require healthcare providers and facilities to disclose their healthcare costs, but not make it burdensome for them to provide this information. What's most important about this bill is that when consumers have this information in their hands, not only will it give them the power to choose their healthcare options, but they'll begin to have more conversations regarding high healthcare costs in Alaska and how they may be able to have some control over the healthcare market. So in front of you, you should have HB 123, and I'm going to go over the three sections. You can either follow me along in the bill or you can follow along in the sectional analysis. So Section 1 is expanded to authorize the Department of Health and Social Services to collect health services and price information. And Section 2 is really the meat of the bill. It's a new section that says that healthcare providers and facilities will compile a list of the most common procedures along with the undiscounted price. This list will also be compiled once a year and posted in a public area or on their website. The list will then be provided to the Department of Health and Social Services, and the department will then add that to their website. If the healthcare provider or facility is not able to compile a list of their most common procedures, then they will be required to compile a list of all of their healthcare services. If the healthcare facility or provider does not submit their list of the most common procedures, the department has the authority to fine the facility or provider after March 31st, and this fine shall not exceed $2,500. And subsection G just goes over several definitions that are in the bill. And lastly, section 3 provides the effective date of January 1st, 2018. That concludes the reading of the bill. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to go over this with you. And if you have any questions regarding the bill, I'd be happy to answer those questions now.
Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Nesbitt? Yes, Representative Klayman?
Actually, I should pass and tell others that are regular on the committee have questions. I'll go left.
All right, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I know that we're looking to obtain information from different healthcare facilities to do comparisons and just to kind of see where we're at with healthcare costs. I guess I'm curious about the fiscal note. With it being a zero fiscal note, I imagine that there will be increased labor costs for maintaining the database imposed in this and cost associated with charging different facilities for possible failure to comply. Madam Chair, just checking to see why it's a zero fiscal note.
Ms. Nesbitt?
Through the Chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. So the fiscal note, actually, I think the department is here to answer any questions regarding that, but it is a zero fiscal note.
And to follow up on the question, this is an awkward thing being both the chair and the sponsor of the bill. I apologize, it's a little bit awkward. The reason is that the bill does not require a database. It simply requires that they upload the information to their website, so there is no building of a database. And you'll see, if you look at the fiscal note, you'll see that they've said that it can be absorbed into their regular workload. Representative Johnston?
Yes, I appreciate the sponsor's attempt to give some flexibility in this. Is there some subjective nature as far as the 25 procedures? Is this somewhat voluntary?
Do you want to do this? Yeah. I'll take it. All right. So the reason that we picked 25 for individual practitioners and 50 for hospitals was in an effort to avoid making it too onerous. However, you know, we're flexible on that number. It seemed that was a practical number to get to ensure that we're covering the most frequently offered services over the course of the year.
And then, and I'm sorry because my digital world is not working today. I don't have the full bill. Well, didn't download completely, but in those 25 and 50 procedures, it's whatever they say are the most frequent procedures. So there's flexibility and subjectivity as far as what they're most.
Yes.
So in some aspect, that's somewhat voluntary.
Yes.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, I should have done a follow-up, so please excuse me. Could we hear from the department with regard to the fiscal note? I'm just really curious on this.
Sure, and we have Joe Lewis in the room from the Division of Public Health, who's going to come up to the front and can answer any questions from the division. Can you put yourself on the record and then answer the question, Ms. Lewis? Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you for the record. I'm Jill Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health.
Okay. And you heard the question, ma'am?
Yes, I believe through the chair.
Through the chair, excuse me.
To Representative Sullivan Leonard, that the question is, how could we do this with a zero fiscal note? Our interpretation of how to implement this in order to keep the cost down is very simple. We would accept probably PDF versions of the cost list once a year, and we would post them as is to a website that would be sortable by most likely alphabetic sorting, and so that would be a very low cost to do that. And we don't really anticipate needing to do a lot of enforcement, that it'll be, you know, self-policing and a good participation rate, because we already have a similar database, and that database does not require a lot of enforcement.
Yes. Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for allowing me to ask a question. There's a couple questions I have about this legislation. The first is a kind of a philosophical one about whether the apparatus of the state should be involved to this degree in private transactions. But the more practical question, which I'll ask first, is could Ms. Nesbitt, could you define what information is envisioned being disclosed, stored, and promulgated? The definition section, the last page, line 3, talks about price. And just put it in layman's terms, if you can, is this the price someone would pay after their insurance companies would pay? Is it the price that someone would expect to pay walking the streets? We'll have some discussion about what information will be disclosed, but what is it envisioned at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if I understand your question correctly, you just want to know what the definition of price is in this bill.
That's correct, yes, ma'am.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the price that we're asking for is the undiscounted price, so it's before any negotiations. It's the, I guess I could say, the charge master price that each facility and provider sets for themselves.
Thank you. And to respond to the original question that you had about the role of government, I would argue that making sure that consumers have accurate information about the cost of services that they're going to purchase is a pretty reasonable expectation for consumers. And since the market itself hasn't done that this is a matter of consumer protection.
Madam Chair, we'll get to that future discussion at the appropriate time.
All right. Thank you. All right. Mr. Klayman, Representative Klayman.
I'm curious why you're only having the undiscounted price, because it seems to me that the average consumer not only knows, so I'm going for an MRI and they're going to tell me the ticket price is $2,400, but then they know very well that every insurance company has already negotiated a discount. Why isn't that also what gets published?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that is a great question. In following the theme of wanting to keep this as simple as possible, we thought that having just the undiscounted price would be a reference point for people to come in and look at something and say, this may or may not be the cost that I will pay, but it is a starting point for them to figure out the cost, whether they are insured or not.
And through the chair, there's no, at least you're not aware of any limits that would prohibit them disclosing what the negotiated price were with insurance companies. If that was in the bill, would there be a problem providing that information?
Those are private.
Sorry, through the chair, Representative Klayman, can you restate that question?
So let's say the bill says, in addition to the undiscounted price, tell me what the average discounted price is that the insurance companies get, or list the average price that insurance companies have negotiated. Why wouldn't that, could that be disclosed if required by the statute, or is there a confidentiality issue for insurance companies that might prohibit that?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I see where you're going with that question, and although it would be in the best interest for us to include the insurance costs in this conversation, the bill is really focusing on the undiscounted price for consumers to see and then make that decision on whether or not they will include other price information, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. Thank you.
Is there any other questions for Ms. Nesbitt while we have her? Yeah, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate Ms. Nesbitt. So is if someone walked in, I guess I want to understand, to put it in layman's terms, if someone walked into an emergency room to a doctor's office and wanted, I don't know, a root canal or something, mm-hmm. would they be presented with a price list at that point and be able to ask the question, do you want the service at this cost or not? Or help me understand a little bit more about how the pricing works currently in the medical business.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, so I feel like you've asked kind of a two-part question. So I can try and explain and articulate to you the purpose of this bill. We would like, or the intent of the sponsors, to have consumers have this price information prior to going into a clinic to receive services. I hope that answered your first question.
That does.
Sort of. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, with your indulgence?
Continue.
Thank you. I think certainly every consumer in a arm's length fair transaction would like to know their the cost basis and all the information. If I'm going to go to a car dealership and try to negotiate for a car, I would dearly love to know what the manufacturer's and the dealer's cost was for the car, mm-hmm. and I could just offer them that price. They could take it or leave it. I'm just trying to find out if that's a reasonable metaphor, or if there's information about a price that might make it impossible to get what you might call a fair price, or the standard price, mm-hmm. or the price everyone's offered.
Take that. Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler, I might take this question. You've actually gotten right to the heart of the issue in many respects. One of the challenges with regard to healthcare pricing is that there is no clear agreement about what is a fair price, and there is a wide range with regard to what is actually paid. In this particular case, we opted for simplicity and to say we're going to ask for the undiscounted price because there are so many different variations, and asking for every variation was not very practicable. Instead, we opted for an undiscounted price, knowing that as we do, that most everybody pays some sort of a discount, but there needs to be a starting point. And then back to your previous question, you asked about where this information would be posted. In the bill, it says that this information will be posted in a public place in the office, and so imagine going into your doctor's practice, and there is a price list up on the wall in a publicly available space where you can see that while you're waiting for your doctor. It would also be on the website, and then that information would also be available on the department's website for the purposes of, comparison. So you could shop around different places. You could see the list while you're in your doctor's office. And it would also be available for, students at the university or, researchers or journalists or legislators if they wanted to do some research on what the gross price is listed. But you've gotten right to the heart of the matter, which is that there is no one price that is paid by anybody. An alternative that we considered but did not advance was the discussion about an all-payer claims database, which was actually recommended by the Alaska Healthcare Commission. But we passed on that because that came with $500,000 a year price tag, which seemed in this particular fiscal climate to be untenable. Representative, I wanted to recognize that Representative Eastman has joined us. Is there any other questions for Ms. Nesbitt? Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Sorry to ask so many questions, Madam Chair. I was just curious, if we are to post these particular procedures and prices, in conspicuous areas of healthcare facilities and what have you, if patients are in the waiting room and they have access to this, does that then kind of open the door to allow them to ask for discounts on particular procedures, kind of open that door for them?
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan-Leonard, I can only answer that by saying yes.
All right. If we don't have additional questions for Ms. Nesbitt, we have two folks in the room who are scheduled to testify. All right. I'm going to ask Becky Hultberg, who is President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, to approach and identify herself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Becky Hultberg, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And first of all, I just want to thank you for offering us the opportunity to make comments on HB 123. And thank you to Representative Svanholz for raising what is an important issue that we have seen in the media both here and elsewhere quite frequently in the last couple of months. We also appreciate the simplicity of this bill and the goal to avoid adding additional administrative cost into the system, which would then just result in higher health care costs. So I'd like to make a couple of general comments about healthcare markets and price transparency, and then address a couple of specific recommendations that we have for this piece of legislation. As I noted, we support the concept of price transparency and consumer engagement in healthcare decision making. The structure of the healthcare payment and delivery system is complicated, and it makes transparency pricing difficult to implement, even when all parties agree on its desirability. Second, it's important to have realistic expectations about what a price transparency bill will accomplish. Economic theory and also reality support the idea that most consumers are only price sensitive and engaged in price shopping up to the point of their out-of-pocket exposure. And so low deductibles or low out-of-pocket maxes mean that price transparency won't matter to most customers. Some will be concerned about price, about cost, regardless of whether they're paying the costs or not. But most are only concerned about cost when it is a dollar that they are paying out of their pocketbook. Most of Alaska's public plans still maintain relatively low deductibles and out-of-pocket maxes. Our private sector plans, I think, till a couple years ago were the same way. We're seeing more migration into higher deductible plans on that end of the healthcare insurance spectrum. And finally, while it seems like the provider would have access to the most pertinent information when it comes to healthcare prices and to help consumers understand price, given the insurance mechanism, it is often actually the insurer that has access to the best data. Successful transparency initiatives sometimes include an insurance component as well, and we'd encourage you to consider that approach as an addition to this legislation. As a matter of fact, some of Alaska's larger insurers already offer price transparency tools to their customers. So that's just something else to consider as an addition. Some specific suggestions on the bill that you have in front of you. The bill requires posting of the undiscounted price for the top 50 procedures for a facility. Undiscounted prices, as I think you've already discussed, are really a reference point. Most consumers are not going to pay the undiscounted price. Insurers pay rates based on contractually negotiated discounts. Self-pay and charity care discounts are often used for patients who do not have insurance. So we just recommend striking the words "charge to an individual recipient" from the language, simply because it is often that very rarely is someone actually going to be charged that undiscounted price. Second, the bill requires compiling the list by procedure and diagnosis code. Just to add to the discussion of complexity in healthcare, the diagnosis codes are very specific. So as an example, for a hip replacement, there could be 30 different diagnosis codes. So we'd recommend just using the procedure code, which should cover the bucket of services that I think you're looking for and I think would be sufficient to accomplish your objective. So finally, if the department's required to post the information on its website, it could be duplicative for our members to post it on theirs as well, since the department may have the best reference point because consumers would be able to see different facilities on the same website. So we'd recommend that you consider removing the requirement to post on an individual provider's website and ask facilities to make the information available and for the state to post on a centralized website. Also, just for consideration, as the bill is written now, we're required to post the 50 individual prices in a public place. Another option would be to require the facilities to have that list available and to publicly post that the list is available, so then there could be a conversation with someone at the facility about what the consumer's cost might be. So those are just suggestions that we have for the bill. So as you've discussed and as we've all noted, healthcare price transparency is a very complex topic. We appreciate that this body is taking a first step toward it because it is a very important conversation to have. And we look forward to working with you on this bill and in other ways to continue to make price information available to healthcare consumers. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Is there any questions for Ms. Hulbert? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, are you familiar with efforts from any other states? And so some of the suggestions you made, is that more in line with what they've done with other states?
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, as Representative Svanholz indicated, there are different frameworks in different states. The all-payer claims database is kind of the gold standard, albeit the most expensive option as well. So some states have chosen this approach. Other states have chosen an approach where they mandate that providers provide individualized estimates. Some of those states have ended up in litigation. So there are a variety of approaches in different states. This is one, and as I noted, I think this really is a foundation and a step for all of us to take to try to, both from a provider perspective, to improve how we provide pricing information, and really just to elevate the attention on pricing information as well.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
I was really interested in the last part that you said, and I guess if you can talk about that in comparison to others that you're familiar with, because what you suggested is not so much the responsibility of the individual to look into the pricing as much as, you know, if you do it in this opposite way where it would say that it's publicly available, it would actually generate a conversation potentially between the client and the provider. And I just wonder if that is why you suggested that, because you think having the conversation is a more effective means than just the expectation that the person would go on a website and be able to sort of make sense of that data.
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, I think generating a conversation is optimal, and so that is one way that a conversation could be generated. We also understand the reason that the bill was written to post prices, but as an alternative, we could be required to make them available and post that they're available, so it would generate a conversation. It's a suggestion. There is no, I think, perfect solution to this Gordian knot of a problem, but I think, this is a good first step, and I hope we've offered what are viewed as constructive ideas.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sather.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a large question, Ms. Hulbert, and through the Chair. Can you speak, Ms. Hulbert, as to what degree are healthcare costs in Alaska currently transparent or opaque, and where they might be concentrated? Help me understand the general landscape of pricing information in Alaska.
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, it probably depends on the type of provider you're looking at. From a hospital standpoint, our prices are very difficult to understand because, as was mentioned before, you start with the charge master price, you layer on the insurance discount, which is variable and proprietary, and then you layer on the deductible and out-of-pocket. However, what we have worked at doing from a hospital standpoint is ensuring that we have staff available to help people when they call to navigate the system to find out what the price is. Is it possible to find the price? It absolutely is. Is it difficult? It absolutely is. The solution to how to make that less difficult is the challenge, I think, that we're all facing, given the structure of the system. I hesitate to speak for other providers because I don't represent them. But speaking from a hospital perspective, that's what we focused on, is making estimates available and helping people to navigate that process of getting a good estimate for themselves.
Follow up. Do not wax too philosophical, but I think classical economics would say the more information each member of a transaction has, the better they can negotiate and represent their interests, and caveat emptor. But I guess the question I'd ask is, would price transparency be beneficial to hospitals or nursing homes, or detrimental, or Is it, you know, it could be better for you, it could be worse for you. I'm just trying to get your response to that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think we don't disagree that price transparency is optimal. I think you're going to find universal agreement that having more information is better for the consumer and it's better for the system. It's a question of, given how our health system has evolved over the last 40 years, how do we do that in a way that doesn't just add cost, but it helps consumers? So there's no philosophical difference on whether transparency is good. It's just the how that is the difficult question.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kleeman?
I had asked the committee staff about having insurance information listed, and you touched on the proprietary issues. Are other states having the discounted rates, or at least for some insurers, published, or is that not possible? Or what's your perspective on, I guess, to put it in a context, let's say your hospital is supposed to list the 50 procedures, and we have one insurance company in the state, I think Premera, that is licensed, and then, of course, the state insurance plan that's administered by Aetna. Would it be feasible to have the 50 procedures in one column? Here's the undiscounted price. Here's the price that Premera has negotiated. Here's the price that Aetna has negotiated on behalf of the state. Could that be published, all three of them side by side, or is that there a problem with doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Kleeman, I'd have to think and ask some of my members about the feasibility of that question, so I'm not quite prepared to answer it directly. I will say that in many cases, insurers themselves or large employers have tools that help their employees find what the price is. There are tools you can purchase, like CastLight or HealthSpark. Many insurers have their own proprietary tools where you go to a website, you enter in information, and the tool actually tells you which is the most cost-effective option for you in your area. I think those things are optimal. However, recognizing that not everyone has an insurer that has that tool, there is some value in in posting prices as a reference point for those patients that do not have insurance. Oregon, it's kind of a model that Oregon used, is trying to ensure that patients with insurance have the ability to get good estimates from their insurers in cooperation with providers, and then also ensuring that there's information available for patients who don't have insurance. And I think this is a step toward that kind of a model.
Mm-hmm. Representative Eastman?
Yes. So agreed on the philosophy part that everyone seems to appreciate. Now, what about the transition? Does the current bill capture a good process for transition, or could it be made better?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think the beauty in this bill is the simplicity. I do not think this would be a difficult bill for us to administer. So I don't remember off the top of my head what the effective date of this bill would be, but I don't have any concerns at this point with what a transition would look like.
Representative Sadler.
Appreciate it. I hope I'm helping the discussion, Madam Chair. Through the chair, the elements of price would be your capital expense, your operating expense, any profit. Are there, and that's just kind of basic business, are there other elements of healthcare services that would include other elements of pricing? And I guess that getting to a question of if this bill were to become law, where might there be any changes in those price elements?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in terms of identifying how you get to a charge master price, I might need like a PhD in healthcare economics to answer that question, so I'll probably defer. However, your question regarding it's just simply too early to tell. I think many states have done price transparency initiatives. I'm not aware that there's any authoritative data out there to suggest that they will indeed lower costs, but many of them are relatively new as well, so it may just be a function of time, that not enough time has passed in order to see the outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnston.
I'm trying to remember there's been a national site, I think it was called Leapfrog, or am I close, where you can go out and you need this procedure and you can sort of see what the costs are nationally and how good the service is. Do you see this information being poached or used as data to do something like that in a grander scale. So it's, I mean, one of the things, you know, of course, is having it in the Northwest region. But so it's just part of a general move towards transparency nationally, and you see this?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, there is definitely a move nationally toward price transparency. It's given the real struggle is that, again, those undiscounted charges are not what most people are going to pay. Mm-hmm. So the importance then is in having the insurer as a partner to be able to identify what the patient's actual out-of-pocket is going to be. So again, this is a component, but then we really want people to call their insurer and call their physician and say, is this indeed the procedure I'm going to have, because it's complicated. And then to call their insurer and make sure that they understand, is this provider in my network? And what is my copay? What is my out-of-network? So there's a patient responsibility piece in the equation as well.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Holtberg? We have another scheduled testifier in the audience. Thank you, Ms. Holtberg. All right. I want to ask John Zasada with the Alaska Primary Care Association to approach the microphone and put yourself on the record.
Thank you. My name is John Zasada. I'm the Policy Integration Director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We are the Association of Community Health Centers in Alaska, that we are required by law to accept patients regardless of their ability to pay. The primary vehicle with which we do that is the sliding scale discount based on income. We do support increased price transparency. An important part of the work that we do with patients in health center is to engage and educate them on how to use the care options and coverage that they have available to them. Alaska health centers mostly currently provide patients with an estimate of charges for particular procedures upon request. And a large number also have expressed that they would be able to compile and post the list of prices for their most common procedures as outlined in the bill. We simply offer two comments on the bill under Article 4B, Disclosure and Reporting. The greatest concern that health centers have is ineffectively explaining how the discount related to the sliding scale discount or insurance, if the patient has that, will be subtracted from the price so that they will know what they have to pay. Federally qualified health centers have a unique bundled payment system so that the price, the rack price that will be represented to patients will frequently be higher than what they might see if they went to a private primary care provider. And there was some trepidation as we were talking with folks about the testimony today about how we can provide them with the information so that, you know, they can effectively talk about the sliding scale discount and not have folks face sticker shock, you know, when they see what our, you know, base prices are. Under Article 4C3, posting the website, health centers are concerned that the requirement to post prices on health center websites may have the unintended consequence of serving as a barrier to care, especially for low and moderate income patients and folks for whom English is a second language. In coming to seek care. Health centers frequently providing sliding scale discount services when a patient presents for an appointment. In-facility posting of the price list along with support to understand the actual cost to the individual might be more effective in ensuring maximum access to care. We appreciate the opportunity to comment, and I'm available to take any questions. Thank you.
Is there any questions for Mr. Zasada?
Just
Mr. Representative Klingman.
John, I know you heard me ask the question about, in addition to the undiscounted price, also disclosing the negotiated price from at least a couple of insurance carriers. Is that doable, not doable? What's your association's perspective on that information being available from the provider?
So I heard the question. Through the chair, 80% of our patients are at 80% of poverty or below. About a third have commercial insurance. Over a third are still, self-pay or uninsured. And so the sliding scale discount really is, the primary way, that we would reduce, the cost from that, from the main rack rate. And I know, in just about every health center, that I have been in, I've seen, eligibility staff, work with patients, if they have insurance to, provide, that price so that they know what they're going to have to pay.
Okay. I think that answers it. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sassanato, I guess basically you guys have kind of a unique model, I guess. So would the transparency of prices, given the fact that your clients generally are paying a sliding scale fee, would the transparency have much effect on people's decision to seek service your place or someplace else? Would this affect your business? Not business, but your services much?
Yeah, I think the one consideration that we had immediately is that especially sharing rack rates on a website again could serve as a barrier to care for someone who doesn't have a lot of health insurance literacy, mm-hmm. Which is many of our patients, and we'd hate to put potential patients off from seeking primary and preventive care based on rack rate that they would see. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we don't think that this would dramatically affect the care we provide.
Madam Chair, could you define rack rate, please?
So I guess that's a little colloquial through the chair. The bundled rate that a community health center would present to a patient includes the presentation of the issue by the patient, the exam, the procedure, some care coordination, and other factors that are built in, mm-hmm. By the actual health center themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this legislation permit you on a website, say, to make sure that you get through the disclaimers about this price will be disclaimed or discounted before you get to a really large amount? I'm just trying to put myself in the position of someone who would be coming to your community center and trying to find that price and wanting to make sure that they weren't scared off by a price that wasn't actually, mm-hmm. is probably not something that's going to mean a whole lot to them in terms of cost. Is it just the way that this requirement is that you're seeing it, is that going to require you to put it like on the very front of the website where you don't have the ability to give some of those kind of explanations beforehand, or what's your view?
Through the chair, I think many health centers would rather have that interaction in person or even over the phone with a patient, because understanding the intricacies of a sliding scale discount system don't frequently lend themselves to being understood well via a website. It's much easier and much clearer to patients, especially those with limited health insurance literacy, to do that in person or verbally. Did that answer the question?
Representative Eason, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so would this legislation let you do that, or are you asking for a change?
I guess through the chair, we would rather not have to post the prices on the website.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question, Mr. Zazada. Does anybody ever pay the rack rate?
So to the chair, Yes. We have a unlucky set of patients who are uninsured, whose incomes are over 200%, who are subject to the full price. They can receive a discount, you know, for early payment or go on a payment plan, as many frequently do, but that is a group of patients who are subject to the full price.
Okay. So some people do pay the full price.
Are subject to the full price.
Sure. All right. Is there any other questions for Mr. Zazada? All right. I'd like to ask Ms. Holtberg to come back up and answer actually the same question.
For the record, Becky Holtberg with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. Madam Chair, I will have to go back to my members and ask that question. I've been told by some that patients don't pay that, but I don't want to make an unqualified statement without ensuring that I have complete information. So I will follow up with your and get that information to your staff if that's appropriate.
Thank you. That would be helpful. It would also be nice to know that if people don't pay the full price, why they wouldn't pay the full price and why there would be a full price that's different from what people would actually pay.
Madam Chair, I know one answer to that is that we also employ sliding scales, mm-hmm. and so what I want to go back and confirm is are there, we provide sliding scales and we sometimes provide a self-pay discount, which would be, so what I want to confirm is are there instances where there is a patient who does pay the full price, because without being able to say that for sure, I don't want to make an unqualified statement.
All right, thank you. All right, and that concludes the invited testimony for HB 123 today. We'll hear public testimony on Tuesday. No, I'm looking at you, Mr. Madsen. Yeah, we'll hear public testimony on Tuesday, and now we're going to take a brief eddy so we can give a chance for the turnover, and we'll move to HB 43 in just a moment. It's 4:01, and we're back on the record. We have Ms. Brooke Ivey from Representative Jason Gren's office to speak to HB 43, new drugs for the terminally ill, also known as the right to try. Can you put yourself on the record and begin with a recap of your bill before we open up to public testimony?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Gren. Just briefly, a recap on House Bill 43, also known as the Right to Try, is essentially legislation that allows terminally ill patients to work with their doctors and drug or device manufacturers to access investigational treatments that have passed the phase one of the FDA's approval process, which is the safety testing phase, but are not yet past the phase two and phase three and are currently in ongoing trials. And have not been made widely available for the public to access. So this could expand access to potentially life-saving treatments years before patients would have normal access to them. And essentially, when talking about clinical trials, we find that fewer than 3% of people who are diagnosed as terminally ill and try to access clinical trials are actually accepted based on their level of illness, either their too sick or not sick enough, and so we're really talking about that other 97% with this legislation. There is a compassionate use program that exists with the FDA where these individuals can apply through their doctor. It's been known to be a lengthy process that doesn't always work for people with terminal illness, and so this is a way of streamlining that access.
All right, thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Ivey? Representative Sadler, the most inquisitive man in the room.
For the record, I appreciate the chairman's indulgence in my questions. I guess that I'm going to start with the philosophical, this one, Ms. Ivey. We already do require some interposition between a healthcare provider and a patient. There's some mediation between them. The drugs that a doctor is allowed legally to prescribe go through some kind of process of testing and validation. So Would the argument be that there should be no such intermediation, that a person should be able to try whatever substance they think might help their condition to save their life now or in the future or to improve their health? I guess I'm probing for the philosophical underlying of this legislation.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's actually maybe not as philosophical because in the actual language of the bill, it does define a very specific situation where someone would have the ability to access this. So as I mentioned, currently through the FDA, you can't apply for compassionate use. It is strictly for individuals who have been diagnosed as terminally ill and they have to confer with their doctor in order to pursue that, but then it goes through a lengthy FDA process and then an institutional review board. So this would maintain that in order to access the investigational drugs outside of that existing compassionate use program, they would have to be diagnosed as terminally ill, have exhausted all other available approved options in consultation with their doctor, and then it would require the written consent of the patient, the doctor, and the drug manufacturer in order to access those medications, if that answers your question.
Representative Klayman.
As a visitor to the room, I'm trying to keep up with Representative Sadler and asking questions. Why is this limited to terminally ill? I mean, I totally understand the value of this with terminally ill, but why isn't this also being considered available for, you know, there's a new procedure that helps with people with bum knees or bum hips that aren't terminal, but somebody's coming up with a new treatment and somebody's willing to try the experimental option?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, again, Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Gren on the record. So this question has come up previously in committee and outside of committee as well. I mean, it is something that has been discussed in other states. This legislation, similar legislation, has actually passed in 33 states, just to give you that context, at this sort of narrow focus, because the idea is that if this, you know, first of all, if this were to be challenged in the courts, which we believe is unlikely at this point, but that the courts are more likely to support a more narrow focus, because if you were to open this up beyond just those who have been diagnosed as terminally ill, in essence, you're kind of opening up the entire FDA drug approval process, any medications that go through the FDA, which is, in our view, not. It's a larger policy conversation than this bill is ready to tackle. Also, this is really focused on individuals who have limited time because they've been diagnosed as terminally ill and they intend to save their own lives if they have the opportunity to try something. Maybe it's a medication that has been used in Europe for 15 years. We talked about that previously. Or is there some medications we're finding out that are in Cuba that have been available to the public that will still need to go through our FDA process. So a physician may know about something that could save a life, but rather than waiting for that full process, we're looking at the timeliness for this particular population. I guess.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions for Ms. Ivey? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the conservative approach that you're taking with what you just said, I think it seems to me we're letting politics drive the question of who gets care. Certainly, any number of Alaskans who might fall into this category without necessarily expecting to die could benefit from an experimental treatment and may very well die even though they weren't expecting to. I would certainly want to see what we could do for those folks as well. And just because, you know, we're state 33 or 34 in this process with a conservative approach doesn't mean that a more proactive approach isn't better. You know, certainly we didn't wait for the rest of the states to legalize marijuana, and perhaps this is an area where we can be a leader for other states as well.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. All right, and seeing that there's no further questions for Ms. Ivey, I want to thank you for coming up, ask you to stay in the room, and then I'll open up to public testimony, if that's okay.
Certainly, and Madam Chair, I would just let you know that I'm also prepared to answer some of the questions that came up from members in the previous hearing, if that there is time, or we can do that at a future time after public testimony.
All right. Yeah, thanks. Let's hold that until after we have public testimony, make sure we have enough time. We have another speaker scheduled at 4:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Can we go to Ken Landfield in Homer?
Good afternoon. I'm here to speak in favor of this right to try bill, mostly because I don't understand why really it's an issue at all. I gather that there are arguments that it creates a sense of false hope, which I don't really think is a valid argument. Hope is hope, and terminal is terminal. I suppose it's been argued that the compassionate use program is sufficient, but it seems clear that it isn't. Otherwise, as has been pointed out, 60% of the legislatures of these United States would not have already enacted a similar bill. Like I said, terminal is terminal, and time is absolutely of the essence. And I would ask that you support this bill, because, quite frankly, I can't think of any reason why you wouldn't. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Landfield. All right, next we'll go to Elizabeth Crum in Wasilla on the off-net.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Crum. I'm calling from Wasilla. I've been a nurse for 38 years and have worked in multiple areas of nursing. One of the things that I have learned is that to take away hope from an individual with a terminal condition is the worst thing in the world that can happen. I believe that everyone who has a diagnosis for a terminal condition has hope. It may be hope for a peaceful death without pain. It may be hope for seeing a child graduate, but everyone has hope, and they need that hope. I believe that individuals will need, I apologize for the background noise, I believe that individuals need the option to try different treatments. Certainly, the FDA has experimental programs, investigational programs, clinical trials, but they have very rigorous criteria. And as the one representative mentioned, it may be that you don't meet the criteria for the knee replacement program because you have an underlying lung cancer. And so that option to try treatment that may or may not extend your life but gives you hope, that may be all an individual has left. And I fully support this bill. I also understand that the individual will have a lot of roadblocks. They have to find a physician who will support them as they try and locate the drug and get the drug to the state. They will have to find an insurance company that more than likely will deny coverage for it because it is experimental. So they're going to have to come up with some way to pay for that treatment. Whatever can be done to ease an individual's burden, if we can write a law that does that, I think that it is something that certainly should be done. And that's just my two cents. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Crum, for calling, and I appreciate it. I want to ask, is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? All right. Seeing none, we're going to move on to Mike Meharry with the 10th Amendment Center in Lexington, Kentucky. Are you on the line, Mr. Yeah. Meharry?
I am. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Meharry. I'm the National Communications Director for the 10th Amendment Center. And we've been supporting right-to-trial legislation across the country pretty much since the beginning. We call it our no-brainer issue because it's really, really hard to oppose, which is why it has passed by large margins, oftentimes unanimously, in 33 states. Laws and regulations are supposed to protect the people, but unfortunately, by their nature, regulatory schemes also create bureaucracy and red tape that can also often cause harm. And even if the FDA expanded use program does meet the needs of some patients, and it clearly does, it doesn't even begin to address the black hole between the end of clinical trials and the final approval of the treatment. And this process can take up to 10 months, and it often leaves patients in limbo. Between the end of clinical trials and final approval, they really don't have any alternatives. And this was the situation that more than 70 cancer patients in Texas found themselves in before Texas passed right to try a couple of years ago. These patients benefited from the state stepping in and closing that gap through right to try, as you have heard in previous testimony. In fact, right to try has been so successful in Texas that the legislature is now considering a bill to expand the program to chronically ill patients. So actually doing what some of the representatives have suggested is actually making it a larger scope program, and they are looking at doing that in Texas now. This type of legislation illustrates the beauty of our federated structure. The American system was never intended to run based on one-size-fits-all solutions imposed in Washington, D.C. We all intuitively understand the dangers of monopoly when it comes to economics. The same dangers exist in monopoly government. It's not that the FDA intentionally tries to keep medicines away from sick people. It's just that the federal agency is overwhelmed and driven by its own institutional pressures. Right to Try is a perfect example of states using their rightful authority to exercise control over local issues. As James Madison wrote in Federalist 45, the realm of state government includes, quote, those objects which in the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people. Access to treatments and medications for the desperately ill certainly falls into that category. So if Right to Try helps even one Alaskan patient, I believe it's worth putting it on the books. And with this in mind, I do encourage you to vote yes on House Bill 43, and I appreciate you allowing me the time to speak. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meharry. We have also Jason Norris on the off-net. He's in Anchorage. Jason, are you on the phone?
Yes. Good afternoon. I speak to you today in support of AB 43 with a short title, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill. I understand your time is limited, and therefore I'll effort to be as brief as possible. In June of 2011, my father was diagnosed with ALS, sometimes known as Lou Gehrig's disease. For those unfamiliar, the disease slowly saps a person's ability to move, rendering them bedridden, and eventually it takes away their ability to breathe, at which point they die. It should be noted it doesn't affect a person's mind, so they're acutely aware of their daily deterioration, so the mind eventually becomes a prisoner of the body. And for my father, this deterioration began in June with a reduced range of movement in his left leg. At this point, he'd been working 12-hour days, 5 or 6 days a week as a machinist, and I feel the need to point that out because, by all accounts, he was a very healthy and strong man who was working very hard in a very physical position. By late fall, he had completely lost the ability to walk. At Thanksgiving, he had our then five-month-old son for the last time as his aunt had become too weak to trust such precious cargo. When he finally lost all movement in his limbs, he would hug our children by muzzling them with his face, as his head was the last thing that he could move. As we entered the depths of winter, he and I carried on what conversations we could, trying to accelerate what should have been many more years of passing knowledge and wisdom from father to son. These conversations became increasingly difficult as the disease made his breathing quite labored, even with the assistance of machinery such as a BiPAP machine. There were many moments, too many to list, but the most painful came when I asked him simply, "Are you angry?" And he responded with what I would characterize as uncommon grace and humility. By then he can only utter one word per breath, and his response was, "I'm not angry. I'm just..." sad that I won't see your kids grow up. Every morning and hours of February 1st, 2012, he passed at the age of 58. And he was a good man. He was my hero, a tireless worker, great role model, unparalleled family man. He took a chance in Alaska in 96. He moved the family from the only home he'd ever known. He came here with no connections, no network, no family, no friends. But the gamble, it paid off for all of us. He saw the potential in this place, and he felt like we all do to make a life here. In the end, I wish that he had been afforded the opportunity to fight his disease with the same ferocity. Recently in the Washington Post, there was an article detailing the experience of a man who has, for all intents and purposes, beaten ALS. He was able to use advanced therapies pioneered by doctors at the Emory ALS Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And through reading about this gentleman, I became aware of the Right to Try movement, and soon thereafter, I became aware of the bill for which I'm speaking to you in favor of today. I implore you to pass this bill and to urge your colleagues in the Senate to do the same. I can't say for sure that the therapies that helped the man in the Washington Post would have saved my father, but they may yet save someone's father or mother, daughter or son. And on that note, I thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Is there any questions for Mr. Norris? I think you said it all. Thank you, Mr. Norris, for taking the time to call in and share your story.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to ask Ms. Ivy to come back up to the microphone. You mentioned that you had some answers in response to questions that we'd had at Thursday's meeting, and I want to give you a chance to get those on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Brooke Ivy, staff to Representative Grin. So I'll just walk through them. I know Representative Tarr, I know she's not here right now, and so I'll follow up with her later. She had asked a question of how the recently enacted 21st Century Cures Act on the federal level will impact this legislation or somehow it involves this legislation. And I'm not an expert on that federal legislation. However, from what I understand in my research, it looks like they've made some efforts to try and allow a quicker path for approval of breakthrough devices is one of the items that was breakthrough medical devices. So through the FDA process, specifically for life-threatening or irreversible diseases or conditions, they called for, they're directing the FDA now to evaluate the use of real-world evidence, so observational studies, patient input, other research in addition to clinical trial data, so that we can approve drugs for other indications, not simply what they initially maybe were being studied for. So those things, you know, may help speed drugs, investigational drugs through the FDA approval process in certain ways, but they don't directly impact the compassionate use program. One element that would is that it's also now requiring drug companies to publish on their website the company's policies on how to access the investigational drugs that they're working on. So whether that's through how to get in touch with the clinical trial or if they are actually allowing that to go through the compassionate use access program. And so it's going to make it easier for doctors, physicians, and patients for that matter, to find out where these can be accessed and how they can be accessed, whether that's through maybe the Right to Try law or the Compassionate Use Program. So that was what I had on that question. I also wanted to correct myself on the record. Representative Kito had asked why Hawaii chose to veto, and at the time I had stated that the governor had not issued a statement to my knowledge on that, and I was had misinformation, so I do apologize. I did read Governor Ige's veto, and there were four main points that he made as to his veto. First was the compassionate use program already provides access to investigational drugs, but as we've discussed, Representative Grun feels that there is a delay through that process, which is why Right to Trial legislation exists. And the second point was that this could potentially interfere with the overall FDA system, which may have unintended consequences of delaying the development of potentially life-saving drugs. As this legislation doesn't
compete with clinical trials, and it requires that someone was unable to participate in a clinical trial before they could go down this path. We don't feel that that's necessarily the case. The third point was that it violates the Supremacy Clause, and that's been discussed over and over again as this has made its way through various states in terms of federal preemption, and it has felt that, you know, that is a floor, not a ceiling. I think that's the statement, and there's an attorney on the committee who could maybe correct me on that. And so that was one of the elements, and that he was unclear what actual benefits the right to try could offer patients. So that's more of a philosophical viewpoint. I just wanted to bring those up and make that transparent. Again, the House and the Senate did pass unanimously this legislation in Hawaii before it was vetoed. So just put that up there. Additional question came up by Representative Sponholz regarding the source of the terminal illness definition. So Linda Bruce was on the line at the time from Legal Services. She wasn't actually the original drafter of the bill, and that's why she had some difficulty answering that question. She and I did dig into it further, though, and it looks like that term, that definition of terminal illness came from Louisiana and Colorado's legislation, and it's been used in multiple other states in right-to-try legislation. So, I have two more questions that I believe need to be addressed. The next one, Representative Johnston, you had brought up BCG, and that medication was developed as a vaccine for tuberculosis, but it's also being used to treat bladder cancers and melanomas. And I know the speaker, Starley Coleman, with the Goldwater Institute, acknowledged that after a drug has been approved by the FDA, off-label use is permitted and legal by doctors. But I just wanted to follow up on that discussion, that I did do a little bit more research, and my understanding is that under the right to try or the compassionate use program, it is also permitted for a physician to prescribe an investigational drug that's in phase 2 or phase 3 for an off-label use. For example, if they find a drug that was intended to treat pancreatic cancer is also showing promise in treating lung cancer, it would allow a physician to also prescribe it in that manner. And finally, Representative Sponholz, you had asked a question about whether the bill's reference to informed consent referred to a verbal conversation as well between the doctor and the patient. And in speaking with legislative legal and upon further research, there isn't another place in our Alaska state statute where informed consent is defined. Mm-hmm. However, in the medical community and under medical ethics, it's generally accepted and understood that informed consent is different from consent in that the patient must understand. So in whatever form of communication they're using, whether verbal or if it's someone who has is hard of hearing, for example, and maybe another form of communication, but the idea is that they understand the procedure, associated risks, other options, and the purpose of informed consent is that the patient fully understands what they're consenting to. So it was legislative legal's opinion that the current definition is broad enough and doesn't over-define it to limit it to any type of communication as long as it's informed and not just consent.
Thank you, Ms. Ivey. You've set a high bar for thoroughness for the rest of your colleagues in the building. I appreciate your taking the time to answer those questions. Thank you for presenting further on the bill today. At this point in time, we're going to set the bill aside and we're going to bring it back on Tuesday. At that time, we'll have a committee discussion and presentation of any amendments that may be introduced. As a courtesy to your fellow committee members and to the public, I ask that you submit your amendments 24 hours in advance so we have a chance to properly review them and we can make sure that they're distributed to the committee and posted on BASIS. If they cannot for some reason and are submitted a day in advance, just let my staff know that they're forthcoming so we can try to make sure that they get expedited in communication to everybody. So now I want to thank Ms. Ivey and invite the key campaign representatives to come up and present information on their 2017 legislative priorities. We're going to be at ease briefly.
Lee Ryan. I'm the chair of the Key Coalition of Alaska. I'm also the executive director of REACH Incorporated here in Juneau. We serve around 350 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities in northern southeast Alaska, and we're one of the top 10 private employers in southeast. Key Coalition, this is our 30th year. So for 30 years, advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities, family members, providers, and other interested parties have been coming to talk to the legislature. It's been a really great partnership. We have seen some incredible things happen. We were able to get a Medicaid-funded home and community-based services system in place. We were able to close Harborview Developmental Center, which was a very costly institution. We've also had legislation passed that's really made a difference in the lives of Alaskans with developmental disabilities. One of them was autism insurance reform that allows people to get services early. And the research certainly shows us that the earlier people get intervention, the less the cost down the road. We had a durable medical equipment reuse program established. So that means that program that otherwise could be sitting in someone's garage can be recycled and made into quality equipment that someone can reuse. And in Kansas' case, they've been running a program like this for many years, and they have seen a $3.15 return on every dollar invested in the program. The Department of Health and Social Services has issued regulations, so that program will be getting going very soon. Last year, the legislature passed the ABLE Act, and that allows certain eligible individuals with developmental disabilities and their families to set aside money to pay for their disability-related expenses without losing Medicaid or Social Security, the very services they need to continue to live into the community. So as a result of this 30-year partnership, we have made, I believe, very effective and efficient use of the limited resources that are available. Key Coalition also has submitted the last several years a number of different cost-saving recommendations that we feel will be have the potential to save the state money, and later on we'll be hearing about one of those recommendations. And now I'm going to turn this over to Emily.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. I'm Emily Ennis. I'm a member of the Key campaign, the Key Coalition of Alaska. I'm also Executive Director of Fairbanks Resource Agency, an agency in Fairbanks that provides services to over 700 children, adults, and seniors each year. And I'm here today to talk about preservation. Definitely, as Millie said, in partnership with you, our legislators in Alaska, services for individuals with disabling conditions have grown and flourished. Alaska is recognized as one of the agencies and states in our country that is on the leading edge of provider services for people with disabilities. And we certainly appreciate your support and your assistance both in legislation and in funding to get us there. I want to make sure that all of you know what a developmental disability is. It is a condition that occurs between the ages of birth and 22 in the developmental years of a child. It generally has a significant impact on that child in terms of life functioning and areas of life functioning, mobility, communication, cognitive development, and so forth. And most importantly, the child is expected to need services generally lifelong, some kind of support service that will enable them to have a full and meaningful life. And that's certainly been our goal in the Key campaign, is to educate you about the needs of individuals who need the supports. From about 100 years before statehood until really into the early 70s, there were no services for people with disabling conditions in Alaska. I used to say the only form of therapeutic treatment and care came in the form of an airplane ticket to an institution outside. I, of course, didn't go back to the mid-1800s, and I would like to tell you that even at that time, individuals, children and adults, were being transported to the lower 48 by dog sled, by barge, by train, by snow machine. Certainly an arduous trip for someone with a significant disability, separated from their family and community, not understanding where they were going, and upon arrival, certainly an institutional setting where they lived was very foreign to them. Many of those individuals never came back to Alaska, separated from their families. They died in the lower 48. We now call them the lost Alaskans, and there are thousands of them. And there is a study right now to try to identify them and reunite them in some way with their families if they still exist. So I bring that up because we have developed services, and they are good services. And I'm going to talk just a moment about preservation, because good services depend on good funding. And I would like to thank you, because as leaders in our government, you have maintained that funding support for us. As we want to keep folks in their community, we don't want to send them out to institutions outside. And most importantly, we want to support their families and their siblings, and make sure that everyone has opportunity for a full life, regardless of this disability that is impacting them significantly. Over the last 50 years, Alaska has developed a full array of services that are wonderful. Housing for adults, employment services so that people can go to work, and believe me, many of them go to work and get out off disability support. Services for families so they can maintain their children in the home, respite care so they can have a break. Sometimes the demanding care of 24 hours a day leads to a family falling apart. 50% of families, parents end up in divorce if you have a child with a significant disability. It's tough. So the services have just been invaluable for both the well-being, the progress, the growth and independence for children and adults with disabilities, but for the extended family. It has meant so much. So I'm here today to, again, let you know, for 30 years, the Key Campaign has been here to educate and provide information about these services and just how essential they are for citizens of Alaska, and to again ask you to work toward a sound fiscal plan so that services for people with significant disabilities can live a full, productive, and meaningful life in their communities. Without the funding, it would be impossible. And to remember that even a cut of $1 million or anything, even less or more, results in some cases, a very catastrophic impact on an individual and family. So today I'm very pleased to introduce Addison Turnbull. Addison is a young man that's grown up in Fairbanks with his family, and he has a story to share about his sister, who has a complex and critical medical condition. His sister, like many of infants and young children, might have spent her life in a hospital, her short or long life in a hospital receiving a skilled nursing care. However, with your funding support, we have developed in our state a way to help families bring their children home, help them parent, help siblings get to know them, and to live a fairly normal, regular life in their family home and community. So I thought it would be important to have Addison share his own personal story with you. And thank you for the opportunity to do this.
Thank you, Emily, and thank you. In 1999, I was 11 years old, and my other sister was 8 years old, and we found out that we'd be getting a new addition to the family. When my sister was born, we found out that while my mother had caught a common cold around month 5 of the pregnancy, the cold had stop the development of my sister's brain, and that had led to a complex series of disabilities. When she was born, the doctors at the hospital gave her 3 months to live, and they told my parents that she would likely never talk, she would never walk, that she would not be able to feed herself, and she wasn't able to leave the hospital after being born for about 8 weeks. My dad is an employee of the University of Alaska, and my mom was a temporary employee at the school district in Fairbanks, and she's also a cleaning lady. Being 11 years old, they shielded my sister and I think from a lot of the details, but my experience was one of our family was stricken by a very real fear and tension, and we were a relatively normal family, and this was really challenging our idea of what we were going to do. In the first month that she came home, there were ambulance visits and hospital visits, things were very difficult. When we finally were able to move past the mood of fear and tension surrounding the question of what are we going to do and how are we going to make this work, it was when we realized, when we learned about FRA and the services that we were going to be able to receive. We were soon brought into the fold, and there were medical professionals who came to our house and saw my sister Claire, and they did assessments, and they not only gave Claire the medical services that she needed to be able to maintain, they also transferred and they also educated my parents on those services, and they taught people who had no medical background how to care for my sister in a way that would allow her to continue to live. The wording doesn't do it justice, but I can just very much remember being 12 years old and the mood in my home changing when we heard the words respite care. What this meant was that my sister, who needs 24 hours of supervision, would be able to be supervised for 8 hours a day by medical professionals, and that was going to allow my parents to rest and allow them to take a break, and that made all the difference. So 17 years have gone by since that time. My parents are incredibly sleep deprived. It's been a largely bumpy road, but my sister Claire is about to turn 18. She's at this point, she's outlived her initial life expectancy by 72 times. The community in which we were brought up into, as a result of all these services, the thankfulness I think that my family feels, it feels like a debt that we can never repay. And I know for myself personally and for my sister, it's lit a fire inside us that's driven us into careers of servanthood and service. And I couldn't be more thankful for that, because it's allowed us to continue serving other Alaskans. And I'm just very, very, very thankful for the meaningful services and the gift that was bestowed on our family for all that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing. I really appreciate that. I'd like to also ask you, could you say your name fully and slowly for the record so we can make sure we get it right?
Yeah, sorry. My name is Addison Turnbow.
Turnbow, thank you.
Millie Ryan again, for the record. The third P that we have is product, and what we're really talking about is Alaskans with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are able to leave full and meaningful lives in the community as the result of the services that they receive. In a lot of ways, I think the system's backwards. The Medicaid home and community-based waivers are a waiver to institutions. So if people request a costly institution, they have to be provided. That's not necessarily what people want. Most people don't want that. Ideally, people should be able to request community services, and then only if needed would you look towards an institution. So the system's backwards, but that's the way it is. And waivers are incredibly important in terms of helping people really be part of this rich community that we all know and love. In a minute, I'm going to ask Shelley and Claire to come up, but I wanted to give you a little bit of information about the results of services. So here in Alaska, there's about 41% of adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities are either working or working towards employment. And the national average is more like 28.6%.
I'm sorry, so could you repeat that number?
Hmm?
Could you repeat that number?
41% here in Alaska. These are folks with intellectual. They're the employed or working towards employment.
Okay.
The national average is about 28.6%. So I think we've done a good job here in Alaska helping people go to work, become taxpayers, all of those things, the purchaser of services. A lot of people live with their families and who provide a lot of unpaid support for them. And I know that Shelley and Claire will come and talk a little bit more about, give you the face again of some of the folks who receive services, both family and the individual.
If you lower it, then we can touch the floor and we'll have a spin-off.
Okay.
You have to always be thinking ahead.
Thank you for joining us. Can you introduce yourself on the record?
Yes. I'm Shelley Vendetti Vukovic, and this is Claire Vendetti, my incredible granddaughter. And we are also here with Key Campaign, and we have benefited from waiver services. And many of you we've been around long enough, many of you have heard her story, but for those that haven't, Claire suffered a violent attack and severe trauma as an infant, and was in a coma in the hospital, and they did not feel she would last 24 hours, and then... There, everyone's looking in, they're going, how cute, I wonder if you can hold still. I multitask really well.
You're doing great, thank you.
And then after a week, they told me she would never walk or talk, and she'd be deaf and blind. Wow. You can see they were wrong about an awful lot of stuff. But I don't know how wrong they would have been without waiver services, because Claire requires constant care, constant medical intervention. Claire was someone who would have lived at Harborview or gone to the lower 48, and instead we have this incredible young lady who is the light of my life, who has brought so much to our family. I think before 9 years ago, I didn't really think about what disability would mean in our lives. And now, it is our life. It is advocating for special education services for the disabled. And we are so grateful, honey. Honey, we have a lot of people watching, please. I need you to be good 5 more minutes, please. And you know, the home and community-based services allow her to stay home. They allow her to make progress. And we're on a journey towards independence. And it helps impact our community. It's not just what Claire receives, what our family receives. If the big picture, what does Alaska receive? Because they helped Claire. Well, I'd like to think that it makes all of us a little better people. We've become educated about others who are different than us. We've gotten to experience the feeling of doing something good for the right reason. And I think all of you have a little black picture book in your office that probably came around about 3 weeks ago. that tells a little bit about a friendship Claire has with her best friend, who was a selective mute, and Claire is blind. Well, Athena signs. Claire could never see her sign, and neither one of them had ever had a friend. But they found each other and held hands. And that's how they communicated. They just held hands and felt. And one day, Athena started talking so that she could read a story to Claire. And a couple months later, Claire saw her Christmas tree. And Claire's blind. But as she is stabilized emotionally and made more progress, she's now having light perception. And for the first time, Claire saw her Christmas tree. And I got to hear Athena sing a Christmas carol. And without the waiter services, how would any of that have been possible? So I am so grateful for this gift. I'm grateful for the gift that Claire has given Alaska, because I see other children in her school that celebrate her success. Like, they took part in it because they guided her down the hall and gave her directions. And so I meet children in the store who tell their parents, oh, that's Claire, look at her cane. And we're raising a whole generation of children who accept the difference, and they're even supportive of it if we support it on our level. And I think that's the gift that Claire brings back.
Huh. Yeah.
Sorry,
Shmacka.
So.
Raise your hand?
Yes, you can do that. Can you tell them who you are?
I'm Claire.
And how old are you?
I'm 9.
And.
What are you?
There's a lot of people up there. So.
Thanks I am for coming, 9. Claire.
Thanks for coming, Claire.
Thanks for having me.
Put your hand.
I say thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's Miss Ivy, honey.
Can you put your hand?
Really quick.
So she responds to voices.
Thank you.
Bye.
Tell her thank you, I help us.
Bye, Claire. So, Millie Ryan again for the record.
Thank you.
So, not only do services help people gain skills and enrich everyone's life, there's also the price component, the fourth P. Home and community services are extremely cost effective. Last year, the Senate had Ledge Research do a study for them, and they found that eliminating the Medicaid waiver programs and personal care assistance program would ultimately cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars. And that doesn't even begin to look at the facilities that would need to be built to actually house people in more nursing homes or institutions. One of the things we also know is that adults with disabilities want to be employed and support themselves financially, and waivers, again, are very helpful there. There's research that shows that waiver-funded supported employment services results in more job placements, higher wages, and more hours worked per week. And I think that may help with some of the statistic I shared with you earlier about employment. And I will say some of the statistics I've been quoting, you are going to get tomorrow when you visit with key campaigners the backup information on each of these four Ps. And I, of course, am happy to provide you additional information if expected. One of the areas that I'm really excited about is a recommendation that we have made to the legislature and the administration for the last couple of years is how can we use technology to help people be more independent and thereby reducing their need for hands-on staff support and ultimately costing less money. And so I came across a program called Simply Home that has that ability to do that. They had great data on people gaining in independence and on cost savings, and we decided to pilot it here in Juneau. We have
one individual whose health had declined, and we were concerned that we were going to have to go to the state and request more hours of service because we would need to increase the staff that worked with him. Well, he's a pretty independent guy. He doesn't like too many people in his face. So we were able to work with Simply Home to assess his needs and get a system established for him. Luckily, he has a trust that was able to pay for that. It wasn't that expensive, but sometimes it's a little bit beyond the ability of the folks we serve to purchase. So I want to ask Alan and Jason Ray from Simply Home to come up and talk with you, tell you a little bit of story of some of the folks they have worked with and what they have seen as a result.
Madam Chair, honored members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Ray. I'm from North Carolina, so I speak a little bit slower. Sorry for that. We were honored to come up here as an invitation for REACH and of the Key Coalition, knowing that they have problems that they are stating to you, and knowing that you as a legislative body are having financial problems. The best way to deal with those are to understand the solutions that have been played now for well over a decade in other parts of the country, where certainly the balances of funding at other states have been much challenged sooner than in Alaska. But the reality is the solution is still the same. If we can find ways for the legislature to save money, it allows then for an opportunity not to have to cut money. And the thing we gave you here, we've done this across the state. Across the states, we've had opportunity to work with other legislatures about understanding the incapacities, both financial and ability to provide care, to utilize the federal definition in the Assistive Technology Act of 98 to connect the needs to solutions. And through here, I've given you on this handout here some additional things from a financial perspective of those savings that then get paired over into solutions. We felt like in Alaska the best way to do that was to come and partner with REACH and to show you how that works in Alaska. So our commitment is to do that. We've already started that process to then provide the solutions that maybe could work here. And more than anything else, just wanted to ask if there's any questions about technology. It's certainly one of those things that escapes all of us or maybe enables each of us in a different way. I want you to know, for the people that we're serving with different abilities, it's much the same way. One technology does not fit all. It's not coming in saying, hey, this is what's going to be used for each person. It's one that connects in a different way. But each time we do that and can provide some kind of savings, we want to then bring that around to creating some kind of solution for the state.
We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Ray, you'll have to forgive us. We talk fast because summer's fleeting up here. So. But welcome to Alaska. My question would be, to help people get some idea of what, when you say enabling technology, let's put kind of a face in that. Give a couple, three, four examples of what kind of ET there is and how it might help somebody with a disability better adapt to life.
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes the largest expense we have as a provider is in people to help others. And if we can find a situation where we can provide 24/7 supports without necessarily always having someone there, what better way to do that? So oftentimes we've got somebody who maybe has a need at a certain time. If we can partner sensors together or allow for an immediate request for assistance from someone in a different place to come and do that, that's how we do that. So we can provide 24/7 care without actually having somebody to be there all the time. That's probably one of the biggest ones. The others are, you know, controlling the environment. We have situations where people have gone from institutional care to living on their own through the ability then to make the control of the things in their living arrangement or in their work arrangement, and being able to kind of go back and forth. So it's kind of a combination. If we think about all the tools we use, and then just use that in a way that maybe would be supportive of somebody's choices on living with independence.
And, Jason Ray, also with Simply Home. Just to give you another face of how this can be effective for individuals, we were speaking with a gentleman earlier this week who has cerebral palsy who received services here in Alaska. And in response to the presentation we made in talking about some of the technology that could support him, he said, you know, I have somebody who is in my living room all night, every night. And while that's great and they're nice people, you know, I don't necessarily want them there when I don't need them. And, you know, I have somebody who is there to turn on my light for me, open the door. And those are things I'd love to have the option to choose to do on my own and not have to rely on somebody to come and provide those things for me. So those are just some examples of you know, outcomes that can be achieved using technology.
Any additional questions? Una mas, Representative Sadler?
Una mas, I guess.
I see the look in your eyes.
And I guess I'd ask this question because we're special here in Alaska and so forth. I guess I don't. No, I'm going to back off. No.
Thank you.
Well, hopefully what we would have, Madam Chair, is the ability then to prove to the department here and others how technology can be utilized right here in Alaska and how that works, creates improved outcomes at less cost.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One question, whatever.
And Millie Ryan for the wrap-up. I wanted to talk a little bit about TK and the kind of technology we're using for him. He was having heart problems, and we didn't know what was happening when he got up in the night. Was he fainting? Was he, that sort of, we just couldn't know because we didn't have staff there all the time. So he has sensors in his bed. If he gets up and doesn't get back to his bed within a certain amount of time, we will get information that tells us. We can go and check on him. We have an iPad that's we can very easily see him. We have things where he can identify who's at the door, just things that's going to make his life a little bit easier and enable him to keep his independence. So he's very excited. We're all very excited to see how that works for him. And there's several other people at Reach who have expressed interest in doing something similar.
Thank you. Representative Eastman?
Yes, through the chair. What level of how many Alaskans that would be eligible for services through IDD do you currently reach, and is there some rough estimate of what type of funding you might need in order to reach the whole population?
That's a really good question. There's probably around close to 3,000 people who are receiving waiver services. There's another 1,000 or so who receive some lower level grant funded service. There's a wait list that can vary from at one time it was 1,200. It's probably more 400 or 500 now. It's a really hard thing to say. I don't know if Emily has any more information to add to that, but certainly the need does not go down. I think certainly with technology, people are living longer too, and people are born every day who might have a developmental disability. We estimate using national figures that there's probably about 13,000 Alaskans who have a developmental disability. Not all of them are going to need a lot of comprehensive services, and they may never need services until they leave school, for example, sometimes, and they're going to need supports then to help them live successfully in the community. But 13,000 is around the number of folks. So if, you know, we're looking at 3,000 or so thirds for the waivers, another 1,000 or so for grants, let's just say seven. So we're up to five if we look at who's on the wait list. So we're not quite there in terms of getting to everybody who might potentially need service. And sometimes people don't need a lot. They just need someone to check in with them, make sure things are okay, and that they're doing fine.
Do you have a comment?
Just a comment. I wanted to say thanks for coming and mm-hmm. for that information. And it's great to know some of the beautiful things that your organization is able to be a part of. And I had some folks reach out to me and share some stories. That was very welcome. A caution, though, don't overstate the case of the good things that you do, mm-hmm. because it's very easy to say, you know, full and meaningful lives. But I know there will always be people we can't reach in the world of finite resources that we have. And And those people do not have meaningless existences before we find them. And if we have to pare back services, their lives will still have meaning. But thank you very much for everything you do.
Okay. Thank you. And I would like to invite you all to come to the Key Campaign Dinner tonight at 5:30 at Centennial Hall.
Thank you. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that same point, I know there's been a lot of discussion about sort of people say optional services through mm-hmm. Medicaid, but when we look at the optional services, they include physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech, hearing, and language disorder services, respiratory care, and some of the, I think even some of the personal care attendants all fall under, mm-hmm. you know, optional services. And so just for the group of Alaskans that you work with, mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider those optional at all. I would think those are kind of the basic services necessary for those individuals to exist and you know, get some need access for health care for the needs they have.
It's Representative Tarr through the chair. Mm-hmm. Yes and no. Okay. Yes, we all think that, but if you go back and look at the optional lists under Medicaid, home and community-based services are indeed one of the optional services. Mm-hmm. And we're so used to having a system available for folks, but they are truly optional. And, mm-hmm. of course, they look different in every state and how they're approached and that sort of thing. So that makes it a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Some states have, you know, a different package of service than we are than we have here, too, and that can make a difference as well.
Thank you. I thank you for coming today and for sharing a bit in particular about how the Medicaid waiver option actually allows us to reduce the costs of services, and that what we're talking about is ensuring that people have services that allow them to stay in their homes and in their families that typically cost substantially less than would the in-facility services that were once the norm of yesteryear. So we're actually looking at preserving families and place commitment while still saving money. So is your question urgent? We're at 5:06.
I think so.
Fire away there, Representative Stadler, our honorary member.
just to help put things in perspective, I understand the historical context that used to be that people would leave Alaska, go to Harvey or something. Now we're seeing more people stay in Alaska. We have the Bring the Children Home initiative, mm-hmm. trying to provide more services. Is it true that we're in a transitional period where it might not be necessarily cost-effective to have people with disabilities receive services? Can we look to a time when there's enough people here living in Alaska obtain services to have a healthy service economy where people can make a living providing these services? Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to put us in perspective in context of a continuum.
Are you talking about the staff we work with?
And service providers, equipment providers, PCAs, whatever.
Like economy of scale?
ABAs.
Representative Sadler to the chair, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Yeah.
There is maybe, are you talking about the economy that's sort of developed by supporting workers who provide these services in the state of Alaska? There is a rather large population of people. In fact, I was once a member of this population that worked to support people with developmental or physical disabilities,
for example.
Are we in a bridging period?
I would say so, yes. That we're certainly not keeping up with a livable wage for our folks at that direct support level. Yeah.
All right, thank you. And with that, I'm going to close today's committee. We are going to be having testimony on HB 25, insurance coverage for contraceptives, as well as taking public testimony on HB 123 on Thursday. That's a correction from earlier. That was my mistake. And then we will be taking invited and public testimony on HCR 3, designating April 2017 as Child Abuse Prevention Month. The time is 5:08. And the committee meeting is now adjourned for House.